Welcome, everyone. We're absolutely delighted this evening to welcome Andrew Davies. I was going to say to Warwick, but I think I'll say back to Warwick. Andrew Davies, of course, has gone on to very much greater things since he left Warwick, but he was, for many years, a teacher in the education department here, and although he started writing in 1960, he didn't leave until the late 80s, after he'd had some very considerable successes. I know that when I first came to Warwick, and people, my friends said to me, "Where do you teach now?" And I said, "Warwick University," and they all said, "God, is that that place where nuns run across the campus?" And it's a very, very strange student health center. And indeed it was. Because Andrew Davies, some of you will not remember this. Some of you are too young probably to remember this. We were trying to work out if some students would know this. And it was about 10 years ago that a very peculiar practice hit the TV screens and had an enormous impact in terms of its satire on campus life, and it was filmed on the Warwick campus, was it?
Actually, permission was refused. There was one scene filmed in the swimming pool, and that was it. It was filmed at Birmingham and Kiel. Birmingham were so secure in their reputation they didn't mind, and Kiel needed the money so badly they didn't care.
Okay. Well, since then, as you see from the programme tonight, Andrew's filmography has been absolutely staggering. He's clearly been extremely productive, producing some of the writing screenplays for, among others, Middlemarch, Emma, Pride and Prejudice, Moll Flanders. And so let's welcome Andrew Davies tonight.
Thank you. Now, that works as well. Microphone works. The little screen works. I've got wonders of technology here tonight, which I shall bugger out probably spectacularly. But tonight I'm going to talk anyway about adapting the classics for television, which is what I've been doing more or less non-stop for quite a while now, and I'm looking forward later on this year to get back to doing some original work, which isn't to say I don't absolutely adore adapting the classics for television. Right, first thing, this is the literary theory bit, which I will get over very quickly. My contention is that every reading of a novel is an adaptation. There is no such thing as the definitive Pride and Prejudice, the definitive Middlemarch, the definitive Emma. There are as many Emmas as there are readers of Emma, which isn't to say that they all have something in common, like the names of the characters and so on, but I think you'll all agree that every time we read a novel, we are interpreting it, we are doing an adaptation of it, we're seeing pictures in our head. I think most readers do visualize. They do actually see scenes in their eyes. And that's partly why you get into such trouble adapting other people's favorite novels, because they say something like, Elizabeth Bennet never looked like that. And in fact, Jane Austen is very, very sparing in her physical descriptions. Actually, she'd be very popular, really, with film writers today, because it's very bad to do a detailed physical description of your heroine in a film script, because you don't know who's going to get cast. So if you say she's 5'4" and red-haired, I mean, that rules out, quite a lot. Anyway. So, I digress very quickly from theory. It's in a way a justification for pleasing myself, in a way, for saying, and this is something I think that you have to do when you're adapting, this is the way I'd like you to see the book. This is what we'd like you like to emphasize. That did get us into trouble with Pride and Prejudice, because, in fact, long before the thing actually reached the screen, our view that Pride and Prejudice is a very sexy novel kind of got into the papers, mischievously interpreted in a very literal way, like Andrew Davis proposes to include sex romps in his adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, which was not true. All we wanted to do was to say that Pride and Prejudice is not, as a lot of people seem to think it is, just a kind of polite social comedy with a lot of little tiny bits of irony and a lot of people standing around in their best clothes exchanging witticisms. It is about deep, fundamental urges, and that the engine of the plot of Pride and Prejudice is Darcy's sexual desire for Elizabeth, because that is what it is to start with. That's what gets the plot going. He fancies her before he's ever met her. He doesn't even like her. He has a big problem. He knows he shouldn't go near her, but he can't keep away from her. It's almost like a film noir in a way. Perhaps one day I will write a film noir adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. But one thing that I wanted to do at the very beginning of the novel in adapting it was try to stamp a little bit of this on it without going completely over the top. I was helped in a way by the plot. Because one thing you learn when you're a screenwriter is that you take things apart very technically, and you look for something which is technically called the inciting incident, which is whatever thing gets the story going. Now, I said the engine of the plot was Darcy's sexual desire for Elizabeth, but things happen before then. And even though Pride and Prejudice is thought of as very much of a novel about five sisters, and two of them in particular, in fact, what starts the story is Bingley's decision to buy a house in that part of the country. He decides to buy Netherfield. And so I thought, well, yeah, that's a good way of asserting our independence from the text, while also being faithful to it. Let's start with these young men, with their on their big horses, with their throbbing thighs, galloping. And nobody started a Jane Austen like that before, and yet we're justified because it starts the story. So that's what we did. Sorry, I've got to establish my relationship with this thing down here for a There we go. And then this thing here. And then it should happen. Actually, another thing I should say here, or two more things. I mean, first of all, I mean, in television, you've got the advantage of being able to indicate like the levels of incomes and the social gradations very quickly and easily by showing the size of the houses as well as the size of the horses. You can the throbbing thighs is one thing, but that's another. And also, I mean, I was daunted by it when I first started. I thought it is my favourite novel, and I do think it's wonderful, but I didn't want to be in a slavish crouch the whole time adapting it. And so I thought, well, let's start off by writing some dialogue that she didn't write herself. let's write a scene, because Jane Austen never wrote scenes of two blokes together. Let's write a scene of two blokes together, a scene that must have happened, that the scene where they actually do it. And it was with some trepidation. My daughter was upstairs working for her finals at the time, and I just sort of wrote that first page, the bit you've seen up to now, and I sort of got it out of the machine and ran upstairs with it and gave it to her, and I said, "Look, beginning of Pride and Prejudice, what do you think?" And she's well trained. She said, "Very good, Dad." And so I went down and carried on. So there's the chaps, their horses' rumps, galloping fast. Big close-up of the heroine, to show she's the heroine. Thinks, bit of new blood in the area, very nice. And somehow, she doesn't know what it is, but something makes her run down the hill. I didn't write those horses in. It was a director's idea. I thought it was a bit premature to suggest fecundity at this point. Actually, we're going to go a bit quickly now. That's the family, you know, the sisters, and here we are coming out of church.
A single man of large fortune, my dear. He came down on Monday, and she's not to see the place. His name is Bingley, and will be in possession by Michaelmas.
I don't know if there's any Beatrix Potter fans here, but it's very much like all those ducks, I think. There you are.
Yes, he must indeed. And could better than one of our five girls.
So why don't you think to choose me?
So that is his design in settling here, to marry one of our daughters.
Design? Oh, how can you talk such nonsense? But you know he may very likely fall in love with one of them. Therefore, you must visit him directly he comes.
Visit him? Oh, no, I see no occasion for that.
Yeah, well, we'll leave them there. One of those things. I just love those that shot of them all trotting along like little ducks, and of course, because Jane Austen writes wonderful dialogue, wonderful and famously wonderful dialogue, one wanted to get it in, and that particular opening of the novel was one of the ones that I managed to get in as dialogue. I'll skip now to like the first it wasn't the first bit I found difficult, but it was a bit that I found difficult. Excuse me a moment while I do a little ejecting here. I have to keep pressing it, otherwise it won't come out.
The rest of the party.
Oh, no. No, that's not. You don't know what's happening down here, but there's a little click and... Ah, there it comes. It's wonderful. You may not have read Pride and Prejudice recently. I mean, I know there are some people here who read it, and Emma and Moll Flanders, in preparation for this very evening. For those of you who didn't, I have to say this, that Darcy's proposal scene, the first disastrous proposal scene, where he just gets it all wrong, and he ruins it. You can understand afterwards why he does it like this, but he does it so badly. I just imagined it in such great length and such detail, and it was a great shock really when I reread the book and found that actually there in the book he starts off. In vain I have struggled, it will not do, you must allow me to tell you how I can't get it right anymore, ardently admire and love you. And then you turn over the page and you think, well, that's a good start, what does he say next? And then he said, he spoke well, but oh my God, it goes into reporter speech, she doesn't do any more. I'm going to have to make it up, what he says. So I'm playing you that bit, partly to in a boastful sort of way, because I thought what I wrote was actually jolly good. Partly because the performance of both of them, and Colin Firth in this particular bit, is just so staggeringly good. And Colin actually provides us with the just about the longest pause I have ever seen before he actually starts off. Yeah, and off he goes. Colin Firth hadn't read Pride and Prejudice when we sent him the first three scripts, and he said, well, what happens? He said, they can't get back together after that, can they? It's just such a brilliant novel. It's just got the best plot. People don't usually talk about too much about Jane Austen's terrific ability to, construct. I mean, it's just like a beautiful, beautiful machine, apart from anything else, that this novel. I mean, it sort of takes them to the point of no return, then brings them gradually back. I'm going to, I have got it. Feyu, my favorite scene out of the adaptation. Sorry about all this stooping behaviour I'm doing here. In it goes. One of the things that was nice to do, and I feel awfully pleased about in the adaptation, was to really. I think we can say it, sort of create the character of Georgiana Darcy, who's a very shadowy character in the book. She never has a proper scene, we never hear her speak. She's Darcy's younger sister, supposed to be very proud, whereas in fact she's extraordinarily shy, vulnerable. The villain Wickham almost succeeded in abducting her when she was 15 years old. So she's had that strange experience of having had a love affair that didn't quite reach its consummation at that age. She was rescued by her brother, who actually feels terribly guilty because he didn't look after her well enough. You're able to show, I showed all that in flashback, establish her as a character. Had some shots with her going to Darcy. Darcy puts his arms round her, so you think, oh yeah, he's actually a very tender chap, and like his good older brother. He'd be a good husband too, perhaps, you know. So it's like foreshadowing all that. And we got Emilia Fox, who has since become quite a big star. But this was just about the first time she'd been seen in anything, playing this sister. And then she plays a really big part in this sweet little scene, which is when Darcy and Elizabeth are just sort of starting to get together again in Pemberley. And we started in the inn beforehand when she's like playing for the first time the lady of the household and issuing invitations.
Miss Bennet, my brother and I would be honoured if you and your aunt and uncle would be our guests.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? And it is also, I mean, besides the other things I was saying, an example of that thing that, as you can see, I adore Jane Austen's dialogue, and I used a lot of it. Sometimes, you know, in a visual medium, like the most powerful things come like when the dialogue is the less important thing, and you show more from the images, and in fact those looks across the room. I was just so pleased with that scene and the way that they did it. That's the best scene I've done yet, I think, in terms of adaptations. And when I say I've done it, of course it's not, you know, I just think of how it would look and sort of pray that they do it. And of course they went that much further than I wrote. And very good, very good. It's one of those things that makes you want to keep on doing it and do more and do better. Right, I'm going to talk briefly about Emma now. If I can, bit dark here. Now, Emma was a different kettle of fish altogether. First of all, for various reasons, which I won't go into in detail, we had to do it as a one-off, as a two-hour film, which I wasn't in a way sorry about. I had a feeling it might go better. I would have liked a full 2 hours rather than the ITV 2 hours. But here we are with Emma. Now, Pride and Prejudice has got the most delightful heroine, in my opinion, in the whole of English literature. Emma, not the same. I mean, Jane Austen famously said that nobody much except herself would like Emma. Although lots of people sort of saying, "Ooh, me, I like Emma." Actually, I don't like her all that much. I mean, or rather, she makes it difficult to like her. And it's a very interesting thing that Jane Austen set out to do in Emma. In just about all her other novels, her heroine is, roughly, give or take, a Cinderella. She's disadvantaged, deserving, usually poor, usually got somebody against her. There is usually a secondary character who is a rich bitch who is out to get her. In Emma, Emma is the rich bitch. She must have made this decision to say, well, let's write about one of these arrogant women, rich, dominating their whole society, but somehow inside, terrified, vulnerable, hasn't got a fucking clue about what life is all about. And this is it. I just love that American Clueless adaptation in which the Harriet character At one point says, I don't know why I've been taking the advice of a virgin who can't drive. And Emma is classically a virgin who can't drive, but yet tries to arrange the lives of everybody else, rides roughshod arrogantly over them all, and yet somehow, you know, you think you're a nice girl underneath, or you try to think that. So I had a bit of a struggle with Emma. The other interesting thing, I think about Emma is it's the most brilliant detective story. That subplot about Frank Churchill and Jane Fairfax is laid into the story so delicately with so many subtle clues. And it's very interesting. You really need to read the book a few times to appreciate it well. Well, of course, in a, you know, on a film, you're trying to get something across to people who are only going to see it this once, and they're probably not going to read the book. And also, a lot of them are rather experienced at watching detective stories, so you mustn't give it away too soon, and you mustn't give it away too late. Anyway, the bit I'm going to play, it's quite a long take, but it's got a lot of good things in, is the Box Hill Picnic, which is the you know, classic climax in a way. It's a hot day, everybody's in a bad temper, they're going out to have a lovely picnic, and everything goes wrong. In a way, the classically famous bit from the book is the Miss Bates bit, which is actually beautifully done by Prunella Scales in this. But I had a lot of other things in mind with this. I wanted the Box Hill Picnic to be the point at which the astute people in the audience who didn't know the book will suddenly get Frank's having an affair with Jane, and it's a secret one, and that's why he's so manipulative and she's so, you know, cold and tortured. Because I always saw Jane in this thing as, like, she's supposed to be withdrawn, you know, not very sexual, frigid, all that kind of, you know, a difficult person. But all those descriptions of her are either given by Emma, who's an idiot, or by, I mean in that respect, or by Frank Churchill, who is just such a sick guy. He just enjoys winding people up and telling lies. In fact, it's perfectly entitled to us to say that Jane Fairfax is a wonderful, delightful, intelligent woman who made the mistake of falling in love with a psychopath, almost, who seduced her at Weymouth. I'm convinced of it. And she has to carry that awful secret the whole time. And so you see why my adaptation of Emma was not entirely successful in some ways, because my sympathies were sort of slightly on the wrong side. Now I've got to grope down to this eject button again. I hope I got my finger on the right one. Yes, out she comes. This is... If you were here, if you were this side of the console, you know what it's like. It's all brilliant. It's high tech, but there is that one thing about it. Okay, the Box Hill Picnic. It's quite long. It takes about 9 minutes, I think.
But Miss Fairfax is to be a
lovely picture. It's like a Gainsborough, isn't it? Yeah, that was my favourite shot out of Emma, just about that bit with the hat where you see the back of her neck and she turns around and tears flow down, and round about that point you think, oh, yeah, she's only a girl, and, you know, and I don't mean that, no, not disparagingly, I mean in a nice way, but she's not kind of some kind of horrible queen who's just lashing out at everybody all the time. She has her feelings too, but it was interesting. It was a tricky old thing, and it got pretty bad reviews here, but very good ones in the States, and I don't really know why. I think it's to do with it's not so much to do with the adaptation. I think it's any questions about like why Emma should not have been received so well as Pride and Prejudice was. Any thoughts? No, none immediately. But if any occur to you, bear them in mind, and because they'll be, we're having a bit of time for questions afterwards. I'd like to show some quick bits at Moore Flanders. Moore Flanders was one where I felt a lot freer, really, to have a bit of fun with the thing, because you don't come across a lot of people say, oh, Moore Flanders is my favourite novel. You don't come across a lot of people who've actually read it to the end. There's a general sort of sense that, whoa, Moore Flanders, whoa, it's a bit whoa, isn't it? And that's actually about all most people know about it. And anyway, it's this kind of very picaresque story, which Defoe based very much on the kind of real life true crime memoirs of famous criminals, and in fact there was a real one called Moll Cutpurse, and he partly based it on real events, partly based it on his imagination of a woman who gets who's born in Newgate Prison, gets taken over by the gypsies, runs away from them, gets befriended and brought up respectfully, gets seduced, gets married 5 times, once to her own brother, falls on hard luck. It's one of those novels. I mean, it's absolutely intriguing because it's a first person narrative, but also she's one of these things known as, or she might be, an unreliable narrator. You believe the facts that she tells you, but not her attitude towards it. She veers between virtue and vice and redemption, and she becomes very religious, then becomes not. She behaves very differently in different periods of her life. I think it's almost quite sort of Brechtian and Marxist in a way. It like challenges the idea of a constant character arc, because her character changes according to circumstance, and the one thing that is constant is a tremendous powerful urge to survive, and she's very combative, and that horrible word that they have now, proactive, she's that as well, so she's quite a sort of popular one for feminists, although rather likably, like she sort of breaks all the rules as well. Anyway, thought how to start all this, how to get some kind of feeling that we're doing some kind of rough show here, and that she's presenting herself, and also she's being presented by Defoe in a rather sensationalist sort of way. And I got this idea that in those days they used to take them around the jails, and so the jailer becomes in a way like her manager, and like they're both doing rather well out of it. It was a public spectacle. If you had the money, you could go to Newgate and actually meet posh villains. It's just like people did in the 60s with the craze. So we got. Here we go. Well, we'll do. Leave Little Moll at that point. Very different style, obviously, as you could see from the you know, rather elegant frame thing, which I thought suited Moll Flanders very well. It sort of stood up very well to the sort of mad rushing round, handheld camera, lots of things in the way, and so on. Not all the scenes in Moll, of course, were like that. It's a terribly episodic story. Sorry about this groping again. Ah, there we are. I think I've got the right one again. It was hard to pick on bits to show you, but I thought we had Diana Rigg, who played her Moll's mother, as an older lady. They meet up again in later life in rather difficult circumstances. Moll has married a Virginian sea captain who's got plantations in Virginia. She met him and sort of thought he looked like a rich enough bloke to marry, and they got along very well. She's not madly in love with him, but they've had three children and everything's been going well. His old mum has got a bit of a secret, which is that she first came out to Virginia as a convict, and Moll gradually pieces it together from certain important details that her mother-in-law is in fact her mother, and so her husband must be her brother. We pick up the story when the mother realizes. Does that make sense? I mean, are you up to speed with the story? Oh, well, never mind. We'll just do our best. Oh, Diana Riggs, the mother.
You must go back to England immediately.
And finally, I'd like to play you. Yeah, just a bit from the end of Moll Flanders, just to show it's a happy ending. In the book, it's quite interesting that in a very sort of realistic, downbeat way, Defoe had her get her release to Virginia and to her happy ending. By a bit of plea bargaining, which I'm sure is the way that these things usually got done in those times. But I mean, we felt in our showman-like way that we ought to take her right up to the threat of the gallows and have one of those traditional endings. And her boyfriend, that I haven't had the opportunity to show you him before. I threaded him through earlier, because another thing about Defoe is that she goes through so many relationships that she only starts with the great relationship of her life, you know, quite near the end of it. But we put him in earlier on. Jenny, so here's a very, very sort of inspiring and uplifting ending for you, I hope. Yeah, I got into trouble with this bit because, somehow I was trying to distill the essence of what Defoe was saying in the book, but Defoe never actually got around to saying it. I was going to have that kind of voiceover with the Defoe voice, but, they thought they'd print it on the screen, and they put it by Daniel Defoe on 70, and somebody, it got shown in America before here, and somebody spotted it and say, hey, that wasn't in the book, Defoe never wrote that. And anyway, right, that's the end of the talk, and now is the time for the questions.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I'm sure we could all listen to you for ages talking about how you feel about those pieces. And there were all sorts of moments when I wanted to ask you questions. I'm going to ask for questions, but I'm going to have the chair's privilege of asking you the first question.
Okay.
That last shot you showed you showed us of your words. You told us at various points about how your words keep sort of creeping in. What for you then is the pleasure of adaptation? I mean, you mentioned Clueless, which is after all sort of disregards the novel but does a sort of total reworking of it in the 20th century. Why are you still so interested in adaptation when your own voice is obviously dying to, in a sense, sort of comment and do different things with the material?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like saying, why don't you leave them alone and write your own stuff? I think it's partly a hangover from lecturing on these things and saying, look, don't you see what this book is really about? And now having this dangerous power of being able to pretend that was what the guy really wrote, I should probably be locked up. Yes. Well, I am trying to write my own stuff now.
Are there other questions? Yes. I'm going to repeat your questions, if you don't mind, so that everyone can hear. The question is, do you write differently when you're going to be interrupted by advertisements?
No, I don't really. Emma was an example of one that did get interrupted by commercials, as did Moll Flanders. You have a certain amount of flexibility with those things, but usually these stories, 19th century, 18th century stories, are so strong that you've often got a choice of exciting moments you can break off at. And so it's not something that I worried about very much, actually. I sort of really rather left it to the producer and director to choose the points at which the breaks took place. But I thought Moll Flanders is such a robust thing. I didn't really mind what went in between. But I remember being terribly anxious with Emma, you know, that they didn't have those very sort of in-your-face tampon advertisements in between, because I thought, you know, it sort of destroy the delicate magic that we had created.
Yes.
Are you surprised we put it in? To what extent is your writing process collaborative?
Writing
for television and movies, it's hugely collaborative. You know, although it stays personal too, but I'm quite often talking about how I'm going to write it before I write. As soon as I deliver the script, the producer and the script editor are wanting to talk to me and coming back to me with various suggestions, saying, Why not do this instead of that, and so on. It's so completely different from writing a novel, that kind of thing. Then you get the script absolutely perfect right, and as some producers say, director proof. And then the director joins, and the whole thing is sort of, you know, thrown apart again, because the director, especially with an adaptation, because he's been able to go off and read the book, and he's saying, well, you know, I have a slightly different take on this thing. And then you're rewriting again. I tend to draw the line when actors tend to come in and say, well, why, let's have
There's this wonderful bit in the scene in the book, darling. I can't understand how you missed it, where my character has a 80-minute speech. But it is, yes, you have to be prepared for a lot of give and take. And I've in a way got to like it. I don't know whether that's masochism, but
Do you have the final say of your script?
No, not usually, no. I mean, I have quite a strong say, you know, and I mean, if I sort of put my foot down, but I usually, you know, usually have to say something like, well, you know, it's like a resigning issue. do you want that scene or do you want me? But it doesn't usually come to that or anything like it, but it can get very acrimonious, yes, and like friendships can be endangered because everybody feels so strongly about what they're doing. Mm. Well, obviously, yes.
Can I just repeat the question? Mm. Sorry. Do you think that adapting something like Pride and Prejudice is more than just a sort of heritage exercise?
Yeah. It can be seen as a heritage exercise, but if you can't see it as more than that, you can't read a book and you can't watch a film. I mean, you need to go to school something. Because Pride and Prejudice is a very strong love story. And many millions of other people think.
What about the sort of negative associations with costume drama, though, and taking up the question?
Well, there is a bit of a tug of war in a way, because people watch things for different reasons, and I mean, costume designers watch it to bitch at other costume designers to say, oh, she didn't get that quite right, but I would think the pleasure, the pleasure of seeing, pretty dresses and nice scenery is one of the minor pleasures of watching one of these things. I think much more interesting and more dangerous is the notion that that really all these things are saying that one nation Toryism is the thing, and that if we just all got together behind Mr. Knightley. Like women wouldn't need to struggle for their rights and so on because they'd be properly cared for by a real proper guy, you know, and Mr. Darcy the same for those who fancied a touch of the lash, you know. The politics of these things, is sometimes a little bit worrying. I think, you know, what they wear and all that, and, it's not very interesting. I mean, except they shouldn't be so buttoned up you can't tell there's people in there.
Yes.
When you're writing, say, for Pride and Prejudice, like, how do you know that
Oh, God, I don't know.
Can I just ask the question?
Yeah, sorry.
this is being recorded, so we must have the questions. All right. How do you know that an hour-long script actually lasts an hour?
Well, it is a difficult thing to do, I think, except I find it easy now. Somehow, the notion of how long the script it is just is supposed to be embeds itself somewhere deep in, and I find myself
you know, drawing to a close round about the right sort of time. But for those of you who are setting out to be screenwriters, if you follow the standard screenwriting format, which you can find out from many books on how to write screenplays, one page would be a minute, roughly. And so that's another way to do it. So another thing is, you know, if it's a 60-minute script and I'm on page 51, I'm thinking, wow, you know, better speed up or tighten up. So that's another thing.
Yes. Are there any novels that fill you with dread, that the idea that somebody might ask you to adapt some dreadful novel?
I have turned down many novels, but amongst kind of great or, you know, novelists or distinguished novelists, I don't think I'd be scared of Virginia Woolf, for example. I am afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Is there anything you want to adapt that nobody's asked you to, or that you haven't yet found?
Not yet. No, I don't think so. Because there may be things that I haven't come across. I've got an absolutely filthy, disgusting screenplay of The Monk. Do you know The Monk? It's a early 19th century Gothic novel that involves sort of raping virgins on piles of skulls and things like that. And it's terribly sacrilegious, and we want Ralph Fiennes to be the star, to be the star rapist. And there's some difficulty with raising the money. So, I mean, that's an example of something that, you know, I'd like to do that doesn't seem to be wholly in accord with contemporary taste.
Perhaps not BBC Children's TV.
No.
Any other? Is one of the reasons that Emma wasn't as successful as some of your other adaptations because you didn't terribly like the character of Emma, and she was perhaps too feminist? Is that what you're saying?
Or not feminist enough, or something? Yeah. Well, I think that might very well be true. Yes. Yes, because as soon as you said about her good relationships, I was thinking, well, what are these good relationships then? You know, I mean, she is kind to her father, yes, but what a dreadful old leech he is. I mean, she should have got. Yes, it's something wrong with me, isn't there? Yeah, I shouldn't have done that book. You're quite right. You put your finger on it.
Gosh.
Could you take us through the time scale of adaptation in terms of the way you plan out the work? Is it a 9-to-5 job for 6 months, or it's here, it's there?
Can you give us the time scale of how you do an adaptation?
It is a bit like a 9-to-5 job for 6 months, in a way, except that it's complicated, certainly in my case, by the fact that there are so many other projects that are either further on or just in the discussion stage, or, you know, suddenly come back to me for rewrites. Yes, I mean, if it's in a, if it's a something like Pride and Prejudice, like six 60-minute episodes, I'll write them at the rate of about one every 3 weeks or one a month. That's the first drafts, and then they go into a rewrite stage. Then the director joins. Then there might be some more rewrites. And then sometimes there's like quite a long time to wait until it gets sort of slotted in for production, and then when it goes into production, sometimes there's more work for me to do, but you know, and it's all very nice, except like just at the moment, I mean, I've just got too many things on the go. At different stages, and I'm not really having time to enjoy it enough, because the bits that I like the most are when I finish my work and I go and watch them do theirs, but I'm in a stage at the moment, I haven't got time to do that because I've got all these deadlines. But yes, something like that 6 months' work, yeah.
Just two more questions. Do you know what impact your adaptations have on the sales of the books that you've adapted?
Well, yes, roughly. I mean, not in terms of actual figures. I know that when a book is adapted for a television serial and that serial is popular, it has a huge effect on the sales of the books. Middlemarch, for example, got read, or at least bought, by an enormous number of people, and it was a very little read book, really, before it was adapted. Pride and Prejudice, of course, has always been a popular book, but it got a 12 million audience, and quite a lot of them bought the book and had a go at it. I don't know about Moll Flanders. I rather suspect, in a way, not. But I really don't know the answer to that. I certainly didn't see loads of copies of Moll Flanders on the bookstalls, you know, in the displayed prominently with pictures of Alex Kingston on the front. No. But on the other hand, there's, like in modern ones, Michael Dobbs's House of Cards, like the adaptation of that for television, made Michael Dobbs into a best-selling author. And, like he's sort of gone on and built a career on that and written a lot more novels.
Just one final question. Yes. What advice would you give to someone who wanted to get into screenwriting?
Well, there are various ways of getting into screenwriting. The best way is to write a masterpiece, write an original masterpiece and get it taken on. Just send it to somebody because, you know, very good work will find its way through. There's another way that people do now, and it suits some people, but I'll tell you what it is. I mean, you just write a speculative episode of your favourite TV show and send it in. And if it's very good, it won't get done or anything like that, but they'll have you into a meeting and they say, you're a really good writer. Is there anything else you'd like to write? Or, you know, we're planning another series and the plot lines are so-and-so. Would you like to have a go at writing one of them? That's very much the way people get into it nowadays. A lot of people are coming up into the, more upmarket ranges of writing, who've started writing for soaps, And in fact, I think the quality of writing in EastEnders is better than a lot of the writing in fringe theatre, for my money.
Well, I think we should finish there. What are you doing at the moment? What's the thing that you're working on? Just tell us.
I'm just sort of signing off on Vanity Fair. I think I've done all my rewrites on that. I've just completed the first draft of adaptation of The Tailor of Panama by John le Carré for a big Hollywood movie, which I'm a bit sort of scared about, really, because it's all a bit sort of big time and huge money. And I am just about to start on two things that both the producers think I'm doing theirs first. Well, one of them is The Count of Monte Cristo, which Roman Polanski is going to direct. Now, I'm actually going to do that one first. And the other one is... I've already written one episode of Wives and Daughters by Mrs. Gaskell. Wonderful book, if you haven't read it. Absolutely lovely book, lovely book. And I'm supposed to be delivering episode two by the end of February, so that and The Count of Monte Cristo. The Count of Monte Cristo is over 1,000 pages long. Aren't you sorry for me? No, you don't.
I don't think any of us are at all sorry for you, Andrew. I think we should... I would just say that we are about to take Andrew off across the nun-bestrewn campus to the English department, to a small gathering there. So I must draw this to a close, but tell you that if you would like a copy of one of Andrew's books that he's brought along, or that the bookshop has brought along, he will sign them before. That's okay, isn't it?
Sure.
You will
yeah.
sign them before we leave. So if people would like to buy things, would they come down afterwards? And can I thank Andrew Davis for a fascinating talk and for engaging so interestingly with the audience? Thank you very much.